would like to talk about comedies and tragedies. As a child, like a lot of children, I love to watch TV. And for me, there are specifically two types of shows that I love to watch as a child. I love to watch cartoons because, I mean, really, who doesn't like cartoons? I mean, you love those rabbits and Elmer Fudd and all those. And I love to watch situational comedies, or for short, we call them sitcoms. You've probably seen them, things like Gilligan's Island, I Love Lucy, Friends, these types of shows. But if you're not certain about them, I'll kind of tell you how they're set up. They're 30-minute segments. They have kind of three parts to them as the story goes along. There's always the setup. That's the first one, which is something like, Dad buys a new television. He loves his new television. He's going to watch the game with all of his friends that night, and the children better not even touch the television because Dad loves it so much. And then there's the crisis that happens probably about 5 or 10 minutes into the TV show, such as the children are throwing around their little brother. He ends up flying into the television. The television explodes. The little brother walks away with no major injuries. But now the children know we've just destroyed our father's favorite television. And they spend the rest of the crisis moments trying to hide the fact that they have destroyed it, either by putting a blanket over it or not letting Dad into the room, anything so that Dad doesn't know what they've done. So you have the setup, Dad loves TV, crisis. Kids have broken TV, are trying to, all they can, don't let Dad know. And it's normally funny in what they're doing. And then the end, you have the resolution of Dad finds out about it, but then because of some manufacturing problem or something, they recall all the televisions. So Dad gets a new television for free. The children are saved. Their lives are not killed. And we learned that it's best to tell the truth in the first place. And we also learned that family is more important than things. I mean, they always end with something happy happening. There's always good feelings. At the end of a sitcom, you're supposed to walk away going, ah, this is nice. Like, life ended up good. This is perhaps a maybe Americanized form of doing things, but the Americans did not come up with this idea of stories. If you go look at Shakespearean literature, they had two types of stories. They had comedies, and they had tragedies. It was very easy to discern between these two. A comedy, what happens is, at the end, the bad guy either dies or gets disgraced, and all the good guys end up with girlfriends or wives, and everything's happy. In a tragedy, at the end, all of the bad guys die, and all of the good guys also die, and all of their girlfriends or wives also die, except for, like, the one person who lived to tell the story about everyone else who died. So these were very easy to tell. Tragedy, everybody dies. Comedy, like, the bad guys get the bad stuff, and the good guys get everything they're supposed to have. The problem with comedies, or with situational comedies, is that do we really ever believe that everything in life, every little instance, ends up happy with everyone understanding what happened, everyone knows exactly, this is how it all works together for the good, right? Like, at the end of these 30-minute television shows, everyone knows, oh, this is why everything's okay now, and we see the answers. But in life, do we really see that? Now, in life, we may believe that tragedy is the bigger story because everybody dies eventually, but obviously not everything goes wrong in every single circumstance. So we don't really trust comedies, but we don't really trust tragedies. And we have to live somewhere in between. The problem is, people come to church and they sing some songs, and then they sit and listen to about a 30-minute talk in which there's kind of the setup of who God is. There's this crisis of, like, these are the things that are going on in life. And at the end, there's this nice resolution where everything ends up happy, and you should be able to go home feeling great, like, oh, I understand everything, and every loose end is tied up all nice and perfect. And so you can come to church and see it like watching a TV show. And you don't really believe a TV show is true. And I wonder, do you sometimes believe if church is true either? Because we try to make things sound so nice. If we look in the Bible, at the very end of it, I would say the Bible ends up with a happy ending. Everything is put right with the world. But I wouldn't say that every little story in the Bible ends up happy. I mean, you see what happens to King Saul or some of the prophets who are always sad and saying, why is everything horrible? There's so many parts in the Bible that don't end up completely happy. The overall thing does, yes. But the individual stories, not always. Take, for instance, someone like Job. Job, to give you just a short thing about him, he was a wealthy man, he had a bunch of family, life was good for him. Then, in one day, family dies, he loses all of his money, in that he loses all his goats and cattle and sheep and everything like that. And he's also sick and has these boils all over his body. So he has this, like, man, my life went horrible in just one day. This is some of what Job says about life and what he thinks. It says, when I think about this, I'm terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe. Their homes are free from fear. The rod of God is not upon them. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him? Have you ever been asking questions like this of, you know, I was living this good life and then everything was taken away from me. And then I look around and I see these people who, they don't care about God. They don't pray. They don't say, God, I need something today, even though we're told we should do that. And they say, forget that. I'll just go out and do my own business, live life the way I want to, and I'll be happy with what I have. And Job is saying, I'm seeing this, and I'm terrified by it. I'm trembling. And Job had some friends that were there talking to him, trying to say, well, this is why it might happen, or this is why that might happen. And we do that in church, or even just with your friends, where someone's having a bad day, you try to say, well, look on the bright side of things. It's all going to get better, or, well, it can't get any worse, or something like that. And I love Job's response to them. Just a little later in the same chapter, he says, I know full well what you're thinking, the schemes by which you would wrong me. You say, well, where now is the great man's house, the tents where wicked men lived? But have you never questioned those who travel? Have you paid no regard to their accounts? That the evil man is spared from the day of calamity, that he's delivered from the day of wrath. Who denounces his conduct to his face? Who repays him for what he has done? Let me make that a little clearer in what he's saying. He's saying, you know what? I know what you guys are going to try and tell me. You're going to try to say some little story about, well, do you see any wicked men living around here? No. So it's all okay and you're making a big fight about nothing? Sometimes we do that in church or in just anything where they'll tell one story of this happened and it turned out great for my mom, so it must be true for everything. We kind of take this small instance and say, well, life is great. So, oh, you just lost your dog today, but you did find €1 on the ground. So that means life is going to be great for you. So what are you so unhappy about? Get over it. And Job is saying, I know you're going to try and do this. You're going to try to take one little instance and say, well, then there's no problems in the world, right? Because this one thing is good. We can do that here. In the Netherlands, there are not as many noticeable problems as there are in maybe other parts of the world. We don't have a cruel dictator that is controlling the Netherlands, that's killing people at whim, that's using everything in a very corrupt way. And so if someone's like, oh, this is not good and the wicked men are rising, you say, well, in the Netherlands, that's not happening. And I loved his question when he says, have you never questioned those who travel? Because maybe in your own little world or in your own sphere, nothing bad happens or everything mostly turns out okay. But have you watched the evening news? Have you paid any attention at all to world events that are going on around you? That's what he's saying. Have you questioned those who travel? Like, have you talked to people who have been somewhere outside of your little town? And do you realize that there are dictators that are killing people at their whim? That there are countries that are so incredibly corrupt? Many of you in this room probably have lived in countries or come from countries like that. And people, you'd say, oh yeah, talk to me. I can tell you that it doesn't always turn out good. That there are countries where just because you're a Christian, you're not going to ever have a chance to be in government because they won't allow it. You may have been working there longer than anyone else, but you'll never become manager because you're a Christian. And that just completely exempts you. And you go, why do the wicked get off good? And I, though I'm trying to live my life great, am getting nothing for it. one more example of these is in Psalm 73, which is one of my favorite psalms in the Bible. The part that I'm taking is not really my favorite part of it. So if you think, man, Matt must be some kind of weird downer person because of the psalms he likes, please, well, wait until the end of the sermon. There's more. But it was written by a guy named Asaph. I don't really know anything else about Asaph except that he writes stuff. He was like a poet and a musician. But it's kind of weird. You know how poets and musicians just have this way of saying something? They have a way with words that they just say what you wanted to say, except in a better way than you could say it. And they put it to music so that it keeps going around in your head. I mean, it just happens. So Asaph wrote, "As for me, my feet had almost slipped. I nearly lost my foothold, for I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They're free from the burdens common to man. They are not plagued by human ills. Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me." He says, I look at the wicked, and he doesn't have any problems. I look at myself. I've tried to do the good thing. I've tried to be the good little boy. I've tried to be pure, and it's getting me nowhere. And I think about it, and it's just oppressive to me. And then we ask God, God, are you fair? And if we know, okay, maybe it's not about being fair, we'll put it in a little more of a like spiritual way of saying it. And we'll say, God, well, are you just? Where's your justice? Instead of using fairness, because justice seems so much more concrete. But fairness, I mean, who says what's fair? Who knows what's fair? But like, God, are you just? Because the good man gets nothing. It's like nice guys finish last. Have you ever heard that statement? So these people are pretty much talking to God and saying, look, where are you in this? What are you doing in this? Why aren't you stepping up? Later in the Bible, we see Jesus come on the scene. And Jesus is called the Word of God. So if these people are questioning God, then, okay, what does Jesus say? Or what does God say about himself? What is God's defense? Then what does Jesus say about who God is? If they're like, God, are you fair? Are you just? What is it? Some of the things Jesus said. In Luke chapter 6, he says, love your enemies and do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. So Jesus is pretty much saying, God is kind to ungrateful and wicked people. So if you think that someone is being ungrateful and wicked, God may very well be kind to them. The people that are your enemies, that he's telling you to love, because he already loves them. So if you think, God, what's up with this? Why are you being nice to them? He says, yeah, I am. I'm kind to those people. In Matthew 5, he says, but I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. He says, yeah, the people that are your enemies, I still give them good things. Well, he says, I give to everyone. It's this idea of generosity, of graciousness, that he doesn't pick and choose and be like, oh, I'll be nice with this one, but not with that one. But he says, you know what, I'm generous. I give to all. Maybe this one seems like he has more than that one, but I'm kind to the ungrateful. And you know what? At some point, you were probably ungrateful and wicked too. I was. I was probably someone's enemy that God was saying, love your enemy and pray for that person. Jesus tells a story in Matthew 20 that maybe helps to show this a little better. There was a man who was a landowner and had a vineyard. And a lot of people in that culture were day workers. You still see that with a lot of immigrant populations, or even in the Virgin Islands when I lived there, I'd see this where guys go out and stand on the side of the road early in the morning. Someone comes along, says, I need three people to work for me today. You, get in the truck. We go. And these guys just kind of wait, hoping that someone will show up and hire them for the day, for whatever amount of time. And if you get picked that day, then you'll get paid that night. If you don't get picked, then you sit on the side of the road and do nothing with your life. This is sort of the setting that he's using of, there are these day workers that are waiting, hoping that someone's going to give them some kind of a job. And there's a landowner, which in this instance is God, that drives up, sees some guys and says, I need you to work in my field. I'll give you one denarius, which is a wage for a full day. So I'll pay you for a full day. I'll be fair to you. Just go work in my field. And they said, great, that's what we're here for. So they go out there. A few hours later, the landowner goes out again, sees more guys and says, hey, if you work in my field, I'll pay you what's fair. They say, okay, great, yeah. At least a little money's better than nothing. And that happens every few hours. He goes out and he gets more people and keeps saying, I'll pay you fairly for it. Even the people who come, they had a 12-hour workday. So none of this like 6 or 8 hour workday of Western culture is like 12-hour workday. At the 11th hour, guys that have been sitting around there with no work to do all day, they're still there. And the guy says, what are you doing here? Go work in my field. At least get an hour of work out of yourselves. And so they do. And at the end of the day, the landowner plans, okay, I'm going to pay you back now for what you have done. And he says to the people giving out the money, okay, grab the guys who worked last, the ones who came in last, pay them first, and then work your way backward in it. So the men who came at the very end of the day show up, and he gives them a denarius, which is for a full day's work. Even though they only worked 1 hour, he gives them the full pay. And this keeps happening, that he's giving everyone a denarius, even the guys that came after 9 hours, people came after all of these. And so the guys who were at the very back of the line, who came at the very beginning of the day, are starting to think to themselves, ooh, maybe we're getting a bonus today. We worked 12 hours. If he's giving a denarius to someone who worked 1 hour, maybe he'll give us 12 denarii for working 12 hours. If not, at least something, a little extra. This is good, because if he's giving that, he should give more to us. And finally, those guys get to the front of the line, and he says, okay, you worked for me for a full day? Here's your denarius. Here's for one full day's work. And they start getting mad, and they're like, we worked all day. They did not. We worked all day. You gave them a denarius. You gave me a denarius. I worked all day. Like, come on. I should get more. Please? And his response in Matthew 20 is this. The landowner says, but he answered them, friend, I'm not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? The question has the answer, yes. Yes, they did. So he says, take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? Doesn't God have the right to do with his stuff what he wants? Or do we get envious because God is generous? He says, look, I promised I would give you this, and I am completely true to my promises. I will give you everything that I promised to give you, whether you worked for 1 hour or later in the day. I will give you everything. So you can either see me as being stingy because I'm not giving you more, or you can realize that I'm actually being generous because I'm giving more than I have to. I'm giving above, honestly, what he promised. But somehow, we sometimes get in this with God of, okay, God's not being generous because of this. And we look at God as unfair, when instead he's saying, no, you're being envious. It's not because I'm not generous. Jesus tells us another story, again, about servants. He says, suppose one of you had a servant plowing or looking after the sheep. Would he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, oh, come along now and sit down to eat? Or would he not rather say, prepare my supper, get yourself ready, and wait on me while I eat and drink? After that, you may eat and drink. Would he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, we're unworthy servants. We've only done our duty. A lot of times we have this like, I deserve everyone to give me a hand clap because of everything that I've done. My parents told me to clean my room and I cleaned it. I should get money and cake for dinner. He says, oh, I should get something for this. And he's saying, if it was what you were supposed to do, it was what you were supposed to do. Now, I'm not trying to make this seem like God, especially with this one, we can get this thought of like, oh, he's talking about them being a servant, so God's kind of this slave guy that's just trying to push you. That's not what he's trying to get to, because we already saw earlier when Jesus said, you will be sons of the Most High when you do things. He's calling us sons and not slaves. So don't get that theologically incorrect. We're not slaves, we are sons. However, Jesus, one of his titles was he's the Son of God, right? And then Jesus said, I came not to be served, but to serve. So that son thought that being a servant went along with being a son. That he knew full well who he was. He knew his power, his authority. He's not thinking less of himself. But he's saying, my intention is to serve. And that's the same with us. We are sons of God, but we're also, we're no better than Jesus to say, no, I'm not supposed to serve. So Jesus is saying all these harsh things. Sometimes people don't like to hear it. I admit, sometimes I don't like to hear it. We're not the first people to go, Jesus, you're not being very nice with this. In John 6, it says, from that time, many of Jesus' disciples turned back and no longer followed him. There's nothing new for people to say, ooh, we like Jesus, and then go, wait a second, maybe we don't like Jesus as much as we thought we did. So they start to walk the other direction. And so Jesus says to his 12, like, close buddies that he chose them to be his closest disciples, turns to them and says, you don't want to go too, do you? Giving them an out of like, okay, you can go as well. We don't see Jesus, when people are walking away, Jesus doesn't run them down and say, no, 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 you didn't understand. Jesus doesn't try to always convince us, like, oh, no, I'm sorry if that offended you. Like, I'm not trying to offend you. Please, please come back. Please follow me. Listen to me. I'm Jesus. Like, Jesus is pretty straightforward in what he says, and then says to his disciples, hey, I know you guys are my buddies, but do you want to go too? And Peter's response is pretty shocking to me in this. Where Peter answered him and said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. He didn't say, Jesus, but we love what you're saying. You're so nice to us. He just says, even if I wanted to go, then what? Where else would I go? Whether I like it or not, whether that is or not, Jesus, you're the one. So how do we kind of transform our mindset from thinking God is this not generous person to realizing he actually is more generous than we want to give him credit for, because he's generous to sometimes our enemies or generous to the people that aren't grateful? Jesus tells another story about two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother. And he says, okay, the younger brother asks his dad, hey, dad, give me all the inheritance now. I want my money now, not when you die. And the dad says, okay. So he gives him the inheritance he's supposed to have. And then the son goes off and decides, party! I got money. We going to party. And so he spent all of his money in wild living. Sometimes people get like that when they're going off to university, that you go, oh, I'm away from family. I may be away from the country I grew up in. Party time! So he wastes his money. He ends up having to be hired out as a worker for some guy. And he starts thinking, you know what, this is, my life is not going really good. I'm going to go back to my dad. So the younger son comes back saying, okay, I messed it up. It was my fault. And the dad decides, hey, we're going to throw him a party. So younger son has gone away, blown everything, lived a crazy life, comes back, and dad says, we're going to have a party. I'm going to put great clothes on you. I'm going to kill the fatted calf. That way we're going to have some good steaks tonight. We're going to have hamburgers. We're going to have everything, because we're going to have a party, and I like to do this. So they're excited. There's a party going on in the house. People, it's a joyful atmosphere. Now, the older brother, he was always the good guy, right? Of the younger brother says, give me my money, I'm going to run off. But the older brother stays with dad. He keeps working. He's responsible. He does all that. And even that day when his brother came back, he was out working in the field. And so he's walking back in from the field, and he hears that there's music thumping out of the house. He's like, what in the world is going on? Where did this come from? So he finds one of the other workers and says, yo, what's up? Why is this going on? And he says, oh, well, your little brother, he came back, and we're having a party for him. And he goes, what? I'm not going to that party. I'm staying right here. He's like, no, your dad really wants you to show up. He's like, no, I don't want to go. Well, what am I going to tell your dad? Tell him anything you want to. Just don't tell him I'm coming, because I'm not showing up. In Luke 15:28, the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never even gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. The you never gave me anything mentality, right? We've had that. Like, why is someone else getting it good? You never gave me anything so I could celebrate with my friends. I found the, like, so I could celebrate thing kind of interesting. Like, I couldn't even go celebrate because you are keeping me from enjoying my life. Have you ever had that with your parents? Or with God? Or with anyone else? I can't enjoy my life because you are keeping me from doing it. it's your fault I'm not enjoying my life. It's probably your fault you're not enjoying your life. Not that there aren't bad things that happen to us, but at that moment, he was invited to a party. And Dad's saying, go to the party. The reason why he's not celebrating is because he's choosing not to go. There is a party available. If you want a party, you can celebrate. Call your friends. Bring them over. You can celebrate with your friends right now. We have a rump steak waiting for you guys. I mean, there's food there. Why are you whining about no parties when there's a party going on? That's not what the dad said. That's just what I would say if I was the dad. But the dad was much better than I was. The son has this, I've been slaving all the time. You never even gave me a goat. And the dad says back, my son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. Forget the goat. It's not about the goat. It's not about being a party. But the two things that he says, make sure you realize, is that you are always with me. I'm right here, and I'm someone who's willing to celebrate. I'm willing to party. So if you want someone to party with, I'm your dad, and I'm right here. You're always with me. And everything I have is yours. Instead of seeing the dad as generous, the son was just envious. The older one was. And the dad's like, no, you're always with me. I am available. You want generosity? My presence is generous to you. If you want to talk to me, I'm here. If you want to do stuff with me, I'm here. I'm available. God is generous to us. I told you at the beginning that my favorite psalm was, or one of my favorite psalms is Psalm 73. I will read some of it and show you hopefully why. Because he says, when my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you. Yet I am always with you. If you just remember what the dad said, he said, my son, you're always with me. And here he's saying, I'm always with you, God. Are you the kind of person that will realize that God is always with you? That God has promised it? And will you say back, just like Asaph does in this psalm, that he will say, I'm always with you. What you said is right. I am always with you. And that's important. Yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. Remember when Peter says, to whom shall we go? That's sort of what Asaph is saying in the psalm. Oh, whom have I in heaven besides you? Who else do I have on earth? Where else would I go? What else do I have but you? So those two things I would say stick out. That I am always with God. And where else would I go? What other choice do I have? Because I've no one else who loves me or takes care of me or has been as generous to me as he has. And his last line, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Even if everything else falls out, even if my heart can't take it anymore, then I'll say, God, be my heart for me. Give me that strength. I had to say that this week, a time or two. I don't know that I have the strength for this. I don't know if I can keep going. My heart's about to fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Portion is like the amount that I have. He's what I've been given. His generosity has given me this. God and what he gives me is better than what I can try to like pull up for myself. So if you've been feeling kind of any of those things, whether envious towards someone else or just in your heart saying, I don't know that God is fair, and I certainly don't think that God is generous, because I look at my life and I'm not getting all that I would want, and I look at bad people and they're getting what they want. I think God would say, yeah, I'm being good to that person because I love them. But I'm being good to you too. And it's not because I'm not giving enough, but that I am generous. And what will you say? What will you realize? Will you say, I'm always with you? Or will you say, no, you make me a slave. I've been slaving for you all the time. That's not the attitude he's calling for. He's saying, you're my son. You're right there. I'm always with you. And you can kind of stay in a sour mood like the older brother did. We're not told that he ends up with a happy story. We're not told what the brother's response is. And I don't know what your response is going to be. You can kind of choose if it will be a comedy or a tragedy. If life is always going to be, no, I never get anything good. Or if it will be, I'm always with you. And everything that God has is mine. Every promise that he made, I'll get. probably even more than I thought I would. Who will you think God is?